I'd like to open the Health, Water, and Environment Committee. Today we have a pretty full schedule here, and we do have to be out of here just before 3:30 because there will be another hearing on the committee here. So there will be some of these that will only get us the sponsors opportunity to talk about them. I'll tap them in and out, and if they have any life left in them, they will be taken up next week. In a full, probably, work session. I would like to start today with House Bill 3280, and that is sponsored by Trustee Beyer, who is here. Christine,
on the work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House Bill 3280 is in your packet. Originally, it was drafted to prohibit transfer of water rights for ag purposes, for agricultural use and non-agricultural use, but you'll find in your packet some -1 amendments, which gut and stuff the bill and make it significantly more simple, and let Representative Beyer explain his amendment.
Now I'll open a work session on the House Bill 3280.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer, State Representative, District 28. Before you, House Bill 3280, as sponsored by me, I think the committee administrator did a good job of describing the bill. I would like to focus from line 3 up and remove everything on the first page, remove everything else and insert, and then I would speak to the -1 amendments on House Bill 3280, which I believe you have in your packet. This bill, this problem was brought to me, my attention, by the Silverton Fire Department, Mr. Vince Herman, who is with me. I'll let him speak to it, to the concerns he has, but what the bill or the amendments simply do, they add the words "and firefighting training," as you see on page 8, page 1, line 8, and they add an emergency clause on the back page of the amendment. That's pretty simply what the bill does. I would like to allow Mr. Vince Herman a chance to speak to the merits and why this is necessary. So with that, you can state your name for that.
My name is Vince Herman. I'm the Assistant Chief of the Silverton Fire District. And I came to this issue by, we're about ready to get an insurance service officer re-grade for our fire district. And one of the forms that they asked us to fill out was for a 50-year drought plan. So I contacted the Water Resources Bureau, and lo and behold, they didn't have a 50-year drought plan. I explained to them our uses, what we're doing it for, and they explained to me that what we were doing in training purposes was illegal. We could be fined for it. My standpoint is not only the Silverton Fire District, but predominantly every fire district in the state has per se schools or residences out in the rural areas, and we carry our water with us with tankers and on the engine companies. And if there are large structures like the Victor Point School, where the needed fire flow is well over 3,500 gallons per minute, we're going to need to haul water and use rural water supply. And for emergencies, we're allowed to use that water. But we need to train. We need to prepare ourselves for something like this to happen. And going out once every 10 years or so to check our capabilities of performing that needed fire flow, finding out that we're in violation of the law, we'd have to fill out permits and certificates and file fees just to keep prepared. And so in talking with the Water Resources Bureau, they suggested that we add in to this ORS, add firefighting and training uses to make it real simple. It's nothing that we abuse, but it's something that we have to prepare for. That's why we're here.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? All right.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. I see we have a few more on our list here, and so another similar representative come in for their bill. We'll continue on this in a moment. Do we have copies of the minutes? No. I didn't come in with any of the minutes. Councilor Pagel, could you come up here, please?
Good bill, huh?
Have you had a chance to look at the amendment?
I am.
This would be your first chance, right?
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Martha Pagel, Water Resources Department.
Okay.
We have prepared written testimony on 3280 in its printed form. With respect to the amendments, we've just seen them this moment. I can tell you that we have previously had discussions with the folks from Silverton concerning their interest in having water available for training purposes, and we obviously understand the need for that type of water use. We did not think a law change was necessary in order to be able to work with them and eventually meet their needs. We had suggested that we work with them on a limited license, what we call a limited license, which is a temporary water use to allow for training, and certainly they could obtain a water right in the future for training purposes. Clearly, emergency firefighting use is already covered as an outright exemption. We have some concerns about adding to the list of exemptions because we don't really know how much water use is required, and training would be an ongoing and fairly regular need, one would guess, and that's of some concern as contrasted with, you know, the actual emergency of a fire situation where you want to be able to take water wherever it's available. So I guess the short response as to the amendments is that we do have concerns. We do appreciate the need and would certainly offer to continue working with the fire department to try to provide water to a limited license with your new water right. Should I go into the printed bill or?
No.
Okay, you have our written testimony.
I've got the written testimony. I appreciate that.
Especially this on record in opposition to that.
Right. I see that.
And we won't do the printed bill.
Okay. So there is a process. And why do you think then that those who are the proponents for this amendment to feel that we need it in statute?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I haven't spoken with them myself. I know our staff have, so I don't know all of the detailed backgrounds of what problems they thought they would have to face in going through the regular process. We do have, as I mentioned, the limited license is a fairly quick process to obtain like a temporary water right for up to 5 years. And it's the authorization to use water as it's available. So, for example, if they wanted to do a training exercise in the middle of summer and take the water from a stream that was already fully appropriated and weren't being able to make deliveries to other water right holders, we would say, no, you can't use your limited license there. But if on any given day, if it had, you know, a good rainstorm or something and they're slow available, they could use it under the limited license. They could also use it from a well. They could use it from, they could fill trucks. And there are a lot of ways that we've worked with other firefighting interests to make sure that they've got water. And we could certainly work with them to find a long-term available water source so that they would have a water right for training purposes. We're just very nervous about creating an outright exemption, as I mentioned, because it's no way of telling how much water is going to be used and whether it's going to interfere with other existing water rights.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. St. Morgan.
Would every fire department that desired to do training be required to get a license?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, most fire departments, I'm not aware that this has been an issue or a problem. I would guess that many of them are served through municipal systems, so they readily have water available to them. If they aren't served by a municipal system, they might be served by a well, and they could certainly obtain a water right. They might have a water supply from any other source, you know, that's available for water rights could be issued. But I'm just not aware that this has been a problem. This is the only time it's been brought to my attention as having a need for
specific need for training.
I have a follow-up. What I would envision in my district, which, as you know, is very rural, mm-hmm. is that there would be training exercises that would probably take place out on the land somewhere, and they would probably try to train in different situations so that they would be able to face different situations as in real life. And I would anticipate that it wouldn't all take place in one spot, and the water wouldn't be drawn from the same spot for every training exercise. So I'm wondering here if the licensing process would really serve the needs or not.
Mr. Ramsey Morgan, I think that would be a reason why you'd want to use the limited license, which is just temporary water right. You can get it with a 15-day notice. It's a very low-cost type of thing to get, and it would say that if you're going to be doing a training exercise in this particular area, we'd like to use this particular creek for just this one time or for this particular season. In other cases, I'm aware that they fill up trucks, so the tanker trucks from the same location and drive it out to the side of the training exercise. So that's the more typical arrangement that I'm aware of. But I think if they are going to be moving it around, if water is available in the source, we are certainly able to cooperate with them and get them the limited license. But if water is not available, then that training exercise, which is not an emergency situation, could injure the rights of other existing water right holders.
Could I ask one more question? Yes. What exactly is the process to get the license?
So, Representative Morgan, there's a fairly short application form that's filled out.
And what's fairly short?
I think it's a page, maybe it's a two-page front and back, to identify what the need is and what the source would be. There's an application fee, I believe it's $100. And if there's an interest in, adjusting the application fee, maybe that's another way to go if that's a concern. There's a process where the water master does an evaluation to make sure that this limited license wouldn't injure other water right holders or the resource. So we do an abbreviated public interest review, and we can make a decision in as quick as 15 days. It does require a public notice, but we have a weekly publication where we get public notice of it.
And who would receive these applications would be the water masters in the counties?
So, Representative Morgan, they would ultimately be finally processed in Salem, but they often come in through the local water master, and the forms are available through the local water master.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yeah, thank you. Representative Morgan, I have some of mine said, yes, I was assuming it's actually so that temporary permit is site specific. And, look, Mark, don't you? Admittedly, training is not an emergency situation, but it's training for an emergency situation. I guess, wouldn't you see the fact that there is a huge public interest in this, and also the fact that filling even a tanker truck it's not like we're depleting the stream to do this. I don't see it as quite the same use as other types of diversions that we're talking about as far as impact. I mean, this is a minor thing, isn't it?
So, Representative Cruz, certainly it can be a minor thing. I think as it's written here, we don't have any limits on it. And if you're the farmer who has a water right, who's not getting enough water under your right to begin with, you might not like the fact that somebody is filling up a tanker truck even though it's for a legitimate public purpose. All I'm suggesting is that I think there are ways that we can work with the interest to be able to meet that public interest without creating a potential conflict with other water right holders.
Yeah, I guess, Mr. Chair, from my perspective, the amount of water that it would take to fill a tanker truck, if that's make or break for my crop, I must have a pretty small crop or one that's incredibly sensitive to water.
If I may, Mr. Representative, it may also be make or break for a listed species. It may be make or break for any number of other public interest uses on that particular stream.
I'm not sure, Martha, that this is a question for you, but perhaps for the previous people. The training must have been taking place up to this point. And I would wonder if you had run into any problems as a result of the training that had been taking place.
Sir, Representative Morgan, I'm not aware of any. I can say with virtual certainty that we haven't ever taken any kind of enforcement action. We might not have known it. Maybe that water use is occurring and we didn't know about it, but I'm not aware of any past problems.
Thank you.
Thank you, Martha. I have, William Klein and let's bring Burton up here because he represents fire district directors, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Burton Weiss. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, which I also am the executive director of in my real life, and wanted to talk to you a little bit about this bill. Number one, there is over 300 fire districts in the state, and 200 of them serve primarily rural areas that do not have municipal water, so this is a very serious issue for fire districts across the state. Secondly, all of these districts have multiple areas that they draw water from in emergencies and for training. And I doubt if there's five of these districts that understand to train to pull water out of locations that they've arranged for, that they're supposed to be getting a license for each and every one of those sites. Silverton, for example, has 32 sites that they draw water from. Three of those are people's swimming pools. And so the issue is not just simply getting a simple license to do that. There's multiple sites. If we put these sites statewide, there's probably over 1,000 sites where water is drawn and identified for fire districts to draw water, and those sites are currently being drawn now. In almost all cases, the fire districts have agreements. Sometimes they're verbal, but often they're written. They have agreements from these property owners. We just don't drive a truck up to a farmer's pond, drain the thing in the middle of the summer and say, oh, by the way, we're going to train with your water. It doesn't happen that way. We wouldn't be in the business very long. We'd have some new directors in the district if that happened. We have agreements with these people on withdrawing the water and taking it out. Also on the issue of permits, volunteer fire districts, the overwhelming majority of them are volunteer fire districts. They're run by volunteers. If they have a paid person, it might be a part-time clerk. Most of them have volunteer chiefs that are not paid or just only paid for their expenses. So when you start talking about applying for permits, and particularly multiple permits, this just isn't a simple issue for these folks, for these volunteer folks to do that in these districts. We don't think that since we're frankly doing it already and there hasn't been complaints about us draining anybody's pond, so A, we don't think allowing us to continue to do this is going to cause a problem. Secondly, we really don't think the permit and going through the process and the $100, and I realize in the world of water, this is probably the cheapest and most simplest permit, and from Martha's point of view, I agree this is a simple permit from her point of view, but we don't think it's achieving any particular public purpose, and when you have these multiple sites in every district, it is going to put a hardship on these districts. For all of these reasons, we really urge you to adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
My name is Bill Klein, the operations chief for the Woodburn Fire District, and I agree pretty much with Mr. Weiss. I think he pretty much said it verbatim for what I was going to say. Got to understand that a lot of these fire departments, not so much right here in the valley, but over east, don't have municipal water supplies, and they train every week out in the rural, you know, and that's where they get their water. And as Mr. Weiss said, there won't be any changes from the way we do it right now. We do use water out in the rural. I believe that what we're trying to do is get a wording change in there to make it so it is a little bit easier and that we are following the laws. And like you said, this permit process, in order to permit each one of our water sites, would be very costly for fire districts, especially small ones that do operate on a minor budget.
How much does standard tanker hold?
Anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 gallons of water.
I don't really recall it, Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
Would you say, could you say with certainty, and I'm sure you could, that the continual training and maintenance of competency is a vital part of your public safety mission?
Yes, in order to be proficient at what we do, and we train our folks, especially when they're volunteers and they don't do this for a living, you got to train like you're going to fight the fire. So if you're not training that way, if you get a fire out there, and we can drop hoses in and use water, you know, on a free basis type thing, but we can't do it because we don't have the permits or whatever, your people aren't going to train the same. And when the fire actually comes, they're not going to fight that thing the same. Especially if it comes to schools, gate cleaners, big buildings like that.
Mr. Chair, if I may, for the record also, I wanted to state that on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, we oppose 3280 in its original form, as well as support the amendments. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Any other questions from the committee? All right. I know most everybody else came to talk about 3280 in the original form. What I will do is hold this to next week, and we'll have a moment to chat with the director of Water Resource Department, and Burton, if you would chat with or two on this, and I'll bring it up next week. Because I have no problem passing that at the moment, but I think gives everybody a chance to take a look at the amendment that we're looking at 3280 in its original form. So, close on a hearing of our work session on House Bill 3280. And let's open. We have Representative Hobson with us. Let's open. We're on the House Bill, the work session on House Bill 3393.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3393 prohibits removal of large woody debris without removal permit except in emergencies, creates exemption from liability for not removing large woody debris in accordance with removal statute. I'll provide some definitions, and inside your packet are the -1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this opportunity. My name is Elaine Hobson. I'm the state representative from District 2. And I think at a time when we spent years working on ways to restore our waterways and our fisheries, that this is a very important bill. It may seem minor, and I've learned already in this process, one never comes and says this is a simple bill and it should pass. It's always more complicated than we anticipate. And I go back a number of years. I lived in Detroit, Oregon for 20 years ago. I am old enough to be of the school where I would hear loggers sitting around at night and saying, oh, brother, I got to pick sticks tomorrow, where they removed all the woody debris. Well, now we have helicopters that fly it in to put it back in there. A number of people have worked on this bill, and I think what it does is bring some balance. The changes that we're going to recommend bring some balance into that whole process and hopefully protect landowners and also provide some additional forms of increasing our resources. And I guess with that introduction, I would like to turn it over to my colleague here, who is one of the movers and shakers and knows considerably more about its background and development than I do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Walt Weber. I'm a retired fishery biologist from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, 27 years and 21 on the Oregon coast, mostly on the North Coast. I'm a board member of the Mechanicum Watershed Council. The Mechanicum is a coastal stream in a seaside area. The council became concerned when we realized that in-stream wood is a keystone of the Oregon plan for salmonid habitat restoration, and yet there is no statute rule that protects that wood once it gets into the stream. Absolutely no protection. Extensive habitat surveys that cover just about every stream on the Oregon coast have revealed that they're pretty much all lacking in stream wood. And with those thoughts in mind, the forest industry and Oregon Wildlife Heritage Foundation and ODFNW went to work about 5 years ago to put wood back into the streams on a short, for a short-term benefit for habitat. And a little later on, rural residential and agriculture began to fence and plant trees with the same idea that eventually these trees would grow up and fall into the stream along with providing shade and nutrients. So some money and some volunteer efforts have been extended to restore this habitat. In some cases, forest buffer strips are being withheld from timber harvest to provide this wood source to streams. Agriculture people are being asked to expand their riparian areas, same with rural residential. A number of agencies have rules that that cover these areas. So we've made quite a few sacrifices, lots of money, lots of time to put this wood in the stream. It just seems ludicrous that we're not going to prevent anybody from taking it out if they choose to. Based on my experiences over the 27 years, I've seen a lot of wood go in the stream and a lot of it come out. And I have a lot of people under the perception that Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has some sort of control, and they would ask me, I'd like to cut this tree out of its gravel bar during low flows, and what do you think of that? And I said, well, I didn't say I had authority, but I would tell them I'd like to see it left there for a fish habitat, and I'd explain to them how it worked. But I didn't talk to everybody, and a lot of that wood has come out. And our council's recommendation was for some sort of a permit process that would give some structure as to whether wood that was in the stream would stay there, would be moved if it was causing a problem. And there's no question about it. Wood in the stream can cause problems for people. It can cause flooding. It can cause bank erosion. And it can be a boating hazard. So we need to deal with that sort of issues. And all of them won't be that way. Some wood will be very innocuous and do nothing but create good fish habitat. Others will cause problems. We thought that a team of somebody representing the landowner side and a fish habitat expert would be a good team to resolve these controversial issues. And I'm thinking maybe of a soil and water district person for ag lands and a forest practices officer for forest land, along with the ODFW fish habitat biologist. Some of this wood that's causing problems needs a timely and kind of a flexible resolution to deal with it. If it's causing a flood, you need to do something about it immediately. If it's a boating hazard, you need to do something about it immediately. So you need some sort of a group of decision makers that can respond quickly. One of the other concerns related to this, and maybe it's an aside here, I don't think it got into the bill, but we're also seeing a kind of inconsistent enforcement of county and local riparian protection laws, and that's defeating the purpose of some of the work that's being done in outside of forest lands. By the way, the state of Washington does have a statute that seems to protect in-stream wood, and I'm not sure how it's working, but it'd be worth researching. We had a chance to look at the draft of, I guess it was the final bill also. I think there may have been some amendments, but now I'm not familiar with those, so of House Bill 3393, and we certainly applaud the intent of the bill. We did have some concerns about it. The first is a kind of a semantics one. It uses the word debris to describe these woody structures. That has sort of a negative connotation, and we'd like to call that woody material instead of woody debris. The 50-yard cubic yard limitation, these are all in Section 1 of that original bill. happens to be line 11, page 2. That provides almost no protection for in-stream wood. For example, a 100-foot long tree, 4 foot in diameter, isn't 50 cubic yards. So this is somewhat relieved by a provision that where essential indigenous anadromous salmonid habitat, and I'm going to call this EASH from now on, is concerned, there is no 50 cubic yard minimum. So, and unfortunately, most Oregon streams fit into that at this point because that represents streams where the fish species in that stream have been designated threatened, sensitive, or endangered. And on line 17, page 2, we're very pleased to see the broad scope that the bill covers in defining the waters of the state, which includes all salmonid habitat from headwater streams down to the estuary. In section 2, on line 30, page 2, it looks like the Division of State Lands will administer the protection process. And as I mentioned before, I think we need, on those issues that are controversial, we need a timely and a flexible resolution to those. And DSL, I don't feel, is set up to do that. Their field people are in Salem. They all have about 3 counties to cover. Typically, the problems of wood that are creating problems occur in bunches following a flood or a big windstorm, so everybody is really busy all of a sudden, and it doesn't seem to me like it seems to me like DSL is understaffed to administer this permit process or whatever develops out of this. And I think the local people that I advocated earlier have a better understanding of flow regimes, fish habitat needs, fish life histories, availability of contractors to move this problem wood. And that's another area that needs to be looked at, is that sometimes heavy equipment is going to have to be used when there's a problem piece of wood. And someone's got to pay for that. Another concern we had was the exclusion of any activities that would remove any activities on this permit process that are customarily associated with agriculture. And it was unclear to us whether stream cleaning would be a customary agriculture activity or not. It seems like it's a gray area. And just as a matter of policy, I guess, as I noted earlier, the only real protection that the original bill was going to provide for in-stream wood was on these EASH streams where fish species are threatened and endangered. And it seems like we would be better off to prevent fish from ever getting to that level and have some protection that guarantees we'll have good fish habitat for healthy populations. I have some photos that just one set, unfortunately, and I have descriptions of what those photos mean. And I can go through each photo if that would be helpful. If not, it's sort of difficult when you only have one set of photos.
We've been passing those along here. I appreciate that.
Would you like me?
I'd like to open up for some questions here.
Well, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Gianella?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I didn't write your name down.
Walt Weber.
Mr. Weber, I was just wondering if there were very many severe cases of the removal of debris.
Now, Mr. Chair, Representative Gianella, as you'll note on those pictures there, there's at least three examples of wood being removed, and that's a 2.5 mile section in the Canicum River, and all this has happened in the last 3 years, and most of it is less than a year old. And in my experience, as I mentioned, I've seen a lot of wood fall into the streams, and I've seen an awful lot of wood come out. I think it's a very prevalent problem. I think a lot of people don't understand why it should stay in there, so there's some educational need there also.
Thank you.
I'm going back over your comments and see if you could clarify something for me. Look at the pictures. I think the pictures are very interesting. First of all, could you explain to me just a little bit more? You want to keep some of the structure, but you want to clean up some of the structure. It's the process of moving or displacing the structure that's the issue. Is that right?
First question. Mr. Chair, Representative Atkinson, as an advocate for fish, I would just assume that all the wood stays in the stream. Every time a piece of wood goes in the stream, there's some instability, and some of those pieces create some problems that I don't think society is ready to say, we want all the wood in the stream regardless. So if somebody will lose their house or a boater's going to drown because of the tree across the river, those are the kind of things that I think need to be taken out or maybe moved. That's what my preference would be, is they can be moved. And that's where a team of people of local knowledge can sit down and say, yeah, maybe we can move this here, or maybe we can move it up against the bank and create some erosion protection.
A couple of questions. What happened to this? I'm familiar with a lot of river systems around the state, but what happened to this river system during that? Did you have a big 96 flood?
The Mechanicum watershed does not have a lot of snow in it, so that was not the biggest flood we've had. We actually had a bigger flood. Oh, yes.
Yeah. I follow it. Did it move a lot of the structure downriver with the flood?
But yes, that's a natural process, and that happens. That's why there needs to be a continuous input.
Just a comment. In the 70s, we had this process of taking structures, trees, whatnot, out of the river. In the 80s, we started putting them back in the river, and the river systems where I'm from in southern Oregon, we went through these fancy techniques of bolting it through the bottom of stream beds and strapping it in, and actually did cool off some rivers and caught more fish. And you're right, I must admit, when I was looking at your pictures, it was, I think 3B, I was actually considering what a beautiful place for trout that would be, and actually probably spent too much time thinking about catching fish out of that fall. So we went through this in southern Oregon where we took structure out and we put structure back in, and then we went through the 90s. We were frustrated with what to do, and then we had the 96 flood and blew everything apart, and it blew away the strap structure and put new stuff in. I think that there's a balance here, but even to our best efforts, I think Mother Nature occasionally changes all of our plans. Just a thought.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkinson, if I could respond to that, I think the key word that you used there is balance. The purpose of this is to provide some balance, and particularly so that the people that are right there can work together to make a determination as to whether or not something does need to be removed in order to provide the greatest protection both for the habitat and for the landowners. And one point I wanted to make also is that the permit process was removed from this bill, and we actually sent this out to any number of people to get feedback on any issues that might be problematic. And I certainly agree with you, particularly the ones that were chained at the bottom. You know, some of those are in there for a good long time, and if Mother Nature removes them, maybe there's something to be said. But I think this does provide a balance where a group of people can make an appropriate decision, and at least that option is open to them.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tino.
Mr. Thompson?
Weber.
Mr. Weber, on your photograph on 4A, you have two different circles, and one of them looks as though the logs on the land is not affecting the river that much. On 2A, it looks as though a tree is broken, and it doesn't look like it's in the river. Or is this part of this proposal to affect the trees that are on the land? And then on 5A, it looks as though a log or a tree is clear across. Is this a river or a creek? It's clear across. It looks as though it could even be a hazard to children wanting to walk across there. That looks like something that would need to be removed. How do you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gianella, let me take these one at a time then. The 2A is a tree that was going to fall in the river. I think the photo is pretty obvious that the base that it's sitting on is actually tilting toward the river. It's pretty amazing that it's kind of the leaning tower of Pisa that ever lasted as long as it did. But that landowner saw that, and for whatever reason, he decided to cut it instead of letting it fall in the river. And that would not necessarily be, that wouldn't be covered by this bill. That would be covered under the county's riparian protection ordinances. I just put that in as an example of maybe a need for a greater riparian vegetation protection.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So this is private land then?
It's private land.
Oh, okay.
Other questions from the committee?
Just an observation, Mr. Weber. I've toured some of the state forest lands out in the area where we both live and work, and I have been impressed with how they've been able to create some habitat just by the addition of some woody material that you describe in the bill. And I know that under the threat of the endangered species and under the Watershed Council's work, we've been trying to get all our state agencies to work together, and that ODOT has provided some of those tree root balls that have gone into the streams. Who is removing them? Are they people who fear that they're damming up the stream and causing erosion to the banks? Or I don't see that many boats on the Mechanicum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, it's a variety of folks that are moving. A lot of it is where there are drift boat activities, and there is maybe 25, 30 boats go down the Mechanicum on a busy day. Fishermen are removing them. Woodcutters are removing the wood. Landowners perceive that as an erosion threat, and maybe correctly, they remove the wood. That's basically where the wood, and generally the people that put it in are not going to remove it. It's when it moves downstream, as Representative Atkinson mentioned, it does move downstream, and we don't tie that wood in like they used to tie it in. And so it's generally, if it's kind of a piece of wood that was put in by somebody else, it's pretty safe until it moves off their property. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I got to fully answer Representative Gianella. She had several sites involved, and I didn't only answer one of those. Did you want me to proceed with that?
If I can.
You mentioned 4A, two trees that were, one of them, they didn't appear to be in the stream.
Not both of them, the one. Yeah.
The one was the one is another one of these ones that was going to fall in. It was obviously leaning way over the stream, and it was cut off before it actually toppled completely in the stream. The other one had been in the stream, and somebody cut it off, and it went down the river.
Oh, Mr. Chair, how many feet away from the stream are you including? It looked like it was back off quite a ways.
Well, that's a picture was just taken the last couple of days, and the water's low, and it was probably submerged at high water.
So how many feet would you follow up, picture? How many feet would you say that would be away from the river?
Well, I'd say that stump is, the root wide is probably 10 feet away from the river right now. But at high water, it's probably
in that
against
photo,
the root wide.
In that photo right now, the one that you brought today, did you say that was only 10 feet?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to present.
What I'm going to do is close our work session on House Bill 3393, and what we will do is probably take this up. We have time. We've got to be out here by 3:30, and I still have a big agenda, and I want to hear from the sponsors of the other bills, too. Give them a chance, and big work sessions next week. So we close the work session on House Bill 3393, and we will open on House Bill. Let's see, do we have any other representatives? Senators? No, nobody keeps showing up for the bills yet. So we'll open on House Bill 2833. Dan, can I have Dan Lee?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Dan Lee with Oregon Water Resources Congress. This is actually a bill to do some housekeeping on irrigation district transfer statutes that we have worked on with the Water Resources Department. I don't believe that there are any provisions of this particular bill that are of concern to anyone. We've addressed several of the other groups to make sure that was the case. What I've done is give you a cut-and-paste version to move the Dash 1 amendments into the original bill in a format that could be followed in the testimony. Section 1 on page A1, the markup page, actually allows for the modification of a certificate so that if you transfer a water right, you don't have to do an entirely new certificate, but you can just do a modification. Districts have certificates with thousands of acres, and this would be a much easier process. The second amendment is on page A2 and deals with the definition of water subject to transfer. This is merely cleanup because the Water Resources Department in the last two sessions adopted this definition in other parts of their statute, but this one particular item, ORS 54580, was not conformed at the same time. Pages A3 and A4 have the certificate modification language again. We have a repeal of a transfer constraint on page A4, section 213. When the bill was originally adopted back in 1995, I believe, there was some concern by parties that there could potentially be some injury to other users outside the district, so a provision was put in the transfer bill at that point that water rights could only be moved once in a 5-year period. That's not workable. There's been no injury. In fact, there's never been an injury in or outside an irrigation district for a transfer that's known of record. So we ask that that be repealed, and the department has concurred on that. Another amendment is an exemption from forfeiture. This is on page A5. We have a process called the 3111 petition process that remaps many of the water rights statewide, over 500,000 acres. Some of those petitions are still in the works, and we're nearing 5 years and beyond. So basically, this provision just says if your petition is still at the Water Resources Department being processed, you're exempt from the 5-year forfeiture. We did the same thing in the last session for other kinds of transfers. The final provision is an the sunset of the forfeiture provision. The way that legislative council drafted this bill is they put the exemption in on page A5 And then on page A8, they remove it again with language in section 5 that just says it becomes operative, the change becomes operative July 1st, 2003.
We had Martha take a look here, so I apologize. We're going to have to go for a moment.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Martha Pagel, Water Resources Department. I'm sorry, I don't have written testimony on this bill, but I can say I do concur with the comments that you've heard from Jan Lee, and we do support the bill.
You've had a chance, Martha, to take a look at these amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we've looked at the amendments, and they appear to do what we all thought they would do.
All right. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We do have 5 members here.
Can we use this?
I can open in the work session. We'll wait till everybody comes back. Take a look at it. I think I'll just close the hearing. I'll close the work session. I'll have to go 28th, 3rd, 8th. I opened that work session, didn't I?
Okay.
Public hearing. Okay, I closed public hearing on Hospital 2833. We'll come back to that one. Let's open a hearing on House Bill 3346. Oh, that's right. We'll wait and see if we have our sponsor come in on that. So I'll close the hearing on 3346. I don't know what's happening on that. Let's open a hearing on House Bill 3356. And if we could have, I know Representative Cruz said he was going to be right here. He'll be back in just a minute. If Pete Chess would like to come forward. I know she didn't get written down on this one, but I figured you would.
Good afternoon, Chairman Welch, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Pete Tech, Associate Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. And we worked with this bill with Water Resources and Representative Cruz since early in last year. And I think maybe it would be wise to let Martha give you hers, and then we'll give a little follow-up and go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Martha Pagel, Water Resources Department. We're handing out written testimony on the bill, which explains that we have worked with the Farm Bureau and Representative Cruz in the interim to develop this, and we do support the changes that would be made to create an incentive for water rights holders to move forward with transfers, which are changes in their water use, and this would allow us to reduce the types of transfers that result in fish and wildlife benefits. And as it's in the printed bill, would authorize this kind of a fee reduction for projects that are authorized through the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board. That would be projects receiving grant funds. Or authorized for a purchase, lease, or gift for in-stream purposes. And the measure would also allow us the discretion to authorize our own staff to assist with some of the functions that otherwise the water right holder would have to obtain capable professional services of a certified water rights examiner. This would allow us to assist with those services and, again, reduce the cost So we are promoting this as an incentive for taking steps that will help with in-stream flow restoration and watershed restoration projects. And we have proposed some amendments. It was with Pete Strickland. The amendment would simply add an additional category of projects that would result in a net benefit to fish and wildlife. And we worked with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to see that that was workable for them. But we're just trying to make sure that we've covered a broad scope of the kinds of projects that we want to provide this incentive for. And I'm afraid we don't have formally prepared amendments, but I think you have Hannah Grove's version.
Would that be a dash two, or are you talking about that at one of you?
It would be a dash one.
So we do have them.
We need to give Martha a quick copy to them.
I have the hand in ghost, but we don't have, so you can have
it. We were looking for them.
Okay. So I have dash one. I've got hand ghost too. Go ahead and Mark can take a look at those.
Joe Wells again, Pete Test of Oregon Farm Bureau. Well, obviously, we strongly support this bill. We think it's a fish-friendly bill, and it's one that provides some incentives to landowners to consider fisheries and other benefits when they try to make management decisions that involve water. This really came to our attention late last year from Jackson County when one of our members who had had some damage done to a diversion point decided to move it after talking with other people to an upstream area and go to a pump, which would have eliminated two push-up dams, plus some problems with cleaning and worrying about that diversion. They got into a GWEP grant situation with it. He put in, I'm not sure the amount of money, but it was a hefty amount of money besides what he was caught shared with. And when they moved and found the engineering spot to change that diversion point with a pump, it was a 10 or 20 feet off of what was allowed without going through the certified water rights examination process, which was $3,000 to $4,000 extra, to carry out the project that was for fish. And even the Water Resources Department and the Water Master said, you know, we really don't have to do this. And it kind of led to some stress and some concerns, and finally Travel Limited came up with the necessary funding to cover that survey to get that done. And that's when we decided that, you know, possibly there's some areas here where we could give the department some discretion, some ability to waive certain conditions and even some fees when people are trying to do management activities that will be benefit fish. So that's what this bill is about. That's why it's here. We support it again. I think it's going to be a benefit to the landowner, benefit to the state, benefit to the public, and I can't see really any downsides to it. But that's my opinion. Thank you for this opportunity to address the bill.
Thank you, Pete. Hey, Mark, if you want a little more time, I can have Reed Benson come up. I know he wants to speak, too.
Mr. Chair, that's how you say this. I've done a quick review, and I think that they correspond with what takes around the hand and goes.
You take a look, and then I'll look for your nod. And, Reed, would you like to come forward?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Reed Benson, the director of Water Watch, just very quickly, we support this bill. We think it's a step in the right direction. I don't know how much the authority to waive fees is in how many areas that's going to make a real difference, but it's a positive step, and we urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Reed. Appreciate that. And I do get the nod from Director Pegg. So. We are in a work session.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cruz.
I would move the dash one amendment to 3356.
Representative Cruz moves dash one amendment to House Bill 3356. Do we have any further discussion? Hearing none. Do we have any opposition? No? Okay. So moved.
Mr. Chair? I would move. Representative Cruz. House Bill 3356 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3356 to the floor with the do pass as amended to the with a do pass recommendation to the floor. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that for the record that it's an interesting spot to be in, being on the same side of an issue with water loss.
That's an eye drag.
I was going to comment that any time that these three parties agreed with Representative Cruz on an issue, there had to be an exceptional piece of legislation.
What's the date today? We're going to mark this one down.
It's not April 1st, so we're okay.
Thank you, Representative Cruz. Okay, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Michelson?
Excuse.
Representative
Devlin?
Excuse. Representative Taylor?
Aye.
Representative Corey? Aye.
Representative
Murphy?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Farewell.
Aye. Having the required number of votes, House Bill 3357 as amended, no, 3356 as amended, passed the vote of the due pass recommendation. Thank you very much. Carrier, who would like to carry this? Representative Cruz, your bill. Representative Cruz carries. And we close the work session on House Bill 3356. And let's open the work session on House Bill 3357. Okay, again, Representative Cruz, do you want to start with this or you want to speak to Pete and Martha?
I'd just say, Mr. Cruz, this is in the same spirit as the last one. And we were in the interim, we were just looking for some ways to add some tools to the toolbox to try to do some positive things environmentally and help both the state and the landowners, and I think we came up with two pretty good minor changes that will move us in the right direction.
All right. Chairman Wells, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Pete Test, Associate Director of Criminal Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau, and like the last bill we discussed, I think it would be wise to let Martha have her shot at this, and then I'll come back with my thoughts.
Chair members of the committee, Martha Pagel, Water Resources Department. I think you have in front of you, we're handing out our written testimony. This bill really makes two changes in current law that we think are sensible and fair-minded to help keep the cost down for making reasonable changes in dealing with water rights. The first relates to application fees for new water rights that deal only with stored water. It's appropriating existing storage or stored water. And the concept here is that under current law, these folks pay a water right application fee that's based on the same kind of a calculation, the same fee structure as any other water right. But the difference is that because it's stored water, we've already gone through a detailed public interest review in creating the storage in the first place, and it doesn't have the same kind of public interest concerns. Certainly a review is necessary, and we do go through a process, but it seems sensible that it should be at a lesser cost. So what the bill would do is change the base fee. We use in structuring our application fees, we have a base fee, and then you add to that based on the size of the appropriation. And this would reduce the base fee from $250 to $100 for new water right applications that are exclusively using stored water. And the other change that it would make relates to the survey and mapping requirements for supplemental water rights. And what that is, a supplemental water right is like a backup water right. It's if your original, your primary source of water is what you use first to serve your needs. Say it's an irrigation need, you have a primary water right from a stream, but you might have a backup water right for a well. So if your stream water isn't available, you could use your well. And typically it's for the same lands and the same type of distribution system as your primary water right. What this bill does is allow us to waive the typical survey and mapping requirements that, where again, you'd have to go out and hire a professional certified water rights examiner to prepare the survey and the map for the use, since you've probably already done that for your underlying rights. When we already have that information available to us, this would allow us to waive that requirement and help cut the cost. It just seems like a practical and sensible thing to do.
Very good. Questions from the committee?
Uh, for the record again, I'm Pete Pest, Associate Director of Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, and I've learned that if you talk too much on something, sometimes you bring up questions you don't want. So I would just say that I think this bill will, in the long run, hopefully motivate some of our landowners to take advantage of those waters that are stored for ag use, hopefully reducing some of the pressure from other sources, and it will also eliminate the extra cost, burden of cost they have to do for supplemental water rights, which can be extreme, $3,000 to $4,000, and under today's circumstances, such a move becomes this. This is a motivating bill, and I hope it will work to help the state and the landowners. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Pete. I appreciate that. Okay. Anyone else want to speak to this? Any other questions? Hearing none. We are in the session. Chair would...
Mr. Chair.
That's improved.
Move on House Bill 3357. As well as the due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3357 to propose the due pass recommendation. I'm sure the discussion. Hearing none. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
Good Atkinson?
Excuse.
Is that one?
Aye. Oh, he's here. He did show up. Thank you. Sorry, though.
You didn't read the letter.
Representative Dino?
Aye.
Representative
Corey?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Morgan?
Aye.
Representative
Taylor?
Aye.
Farewell. Aye. And having the required number of votes, House Bill 3357 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carry. You want to carry that?
Well,
you have to announce it.
I will.
Okay. That's your crew, sir.
Okay.
Okay. Let's approve the carrier, and we close the work session on House Bill 3357. And let's open a hearing on House Bill 3236. And Martha, would you come up and give us this?
Yes.
I'm not stressing you a little bit.
I spoke with Preston Jensen on this, and he wasn't sure he was going to be able to make it. Unless he had sent staff, so I just wanted to see where the department was on this. I see everybody's opposed, maybe one kind of in between, but I just want to get a kind of a general flavor here. We see whether what problems we have, see, maybe bring it back next week.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Martha Pagel, Water Resources. We're handing out our written testimony on the measure. This bill relates to a permit extension process. And if you'll recall, the way water rights operate is you first get a permit. When you first apply for the new water use, you get a permit. Generally, you're given 5 years, or up to a maximum of 5 years, to develop the water use, put the water to beneficial use, and then come in and obtain a final certificate, which is your permanent water rights. This bill relates to a process. If you don't complete the process of developing it within 5 years, there's a provision in the statute that allows an extension to be granted. It's been a fairly tough and controversial issue for us during this past interim. In fallout from some Attorney General advice that we received about our extension program and about interpretation of the current law, which says that we may grant an extension for good cause shown. And then the statute refers to some specific factors that we're supposed to evaluate in deciding whether good cause exists. We were instructed by the AG's office that our existing rules, administrative rules for the permit extension program, were not adequate under the current law, and so we went through a rulemaking process to change our rules. We had a rules advisory committee. They spent many, many hours, did a lot of hard work on this, and we tried very hard to reach consensus, but it was a tall order to act on this type of an issue. What we ultimately wound up with was kind of a truce or a compromise among some of the key interest groups. I'm certainly not here to say that there was a full-blown consensus on the rules that were adopted, but by some key interest groups that we worked with, including the Farm Bureau and the Water Resources Congress, where we adopted a fairly complicated set of rules. There's what we call the short form and the long form. All this is described in my testimony, so I won't belabor it. But basically, we adopted these rules. The short form rules are in effect right now. They basically mirror our past program and the current. They're consistent with the current law. And we are proceeding under the short form rules for the next 2 years. The long form rules will then kick in, I think, July of 2001. The reason for that is to give people sort of fair notice that the process is going to change and to encourage people who have permits right now to go ahead and get them completed within their initial five-year period. So when our commission adopted these rules, we had kind of an agreement with those key stakeholder groups that we'd all sort of give us a chance to see how they work. And we have been implementing them since they were adopted. We've issued 30 final orders approving extensions. We have 130 proposed final orders approving extensions. We've recommended 5 for denial, and we haven't had any protests. So I think we are proceeding through the workload, and I think it seems to be working pretty well. And we oppose the measure because we want to hold to sort of the agreement that was reached when our commission adopted the rules to give us a chance to see how we do. If you think we are not carrying out the law appropriately, there will be the next session before the long-form rules come into effect.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Martha, I appreciate that. Okay, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 3236. Open a hearing on 3216. And we have, looks like, Representative Devlin and Tafoy. Do you want to talk a little bit about this? Representative Devlin. Mm-hmm.
3216.
He's a better talker than I am. That would be a problem.
Welcome, Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for giving a hearing to this bill. Colleagues, this bill, let me first of all preface by saying that this is one of those bills where you send off bills to legislative council, and I sent off about 20. And sometimes they come back not exactly what you had hoped for, but they come back the day that you have to turn them in. And that is the case with this bill. You will see that there is a dash one amendment that virtually replaces the vast majority of the bill and more clearly identifies the actual purposes of the bill. Let me state for the record just some basic background. The bill as amended by the dash one. The reason we're bringing it forward is that currently an effective system to assess public health risks and provide outreach for issues of public health concern in the Willamette River Basin does not exist. In recent years, the Oregon Health Division has issued an advisory on frequent consumption of sawfish and bass from the Willamette because of the potential for ingestion of mercury and other advisory on the consumption of fish from the Columbia Slough because of potential for exposure to various toxics. The Department of Environmental Quality has found that fish with skeletal deformities and other abnormalities, as well as elevated levels of dioxin in those waters. HB 3216 is amended would establish a program to assess the health risks of contaminated water in the Willamette Basin and direct the Oregon Health Division to provide outreach to educate the public about risks from frequent consumption of contaminated fish, proper preparation of such contaminated fish, and risk associated with swimming in contaminated water. While permanent fish advisories are generally posted and temporary problems are typically published in newspapers, barriers such as language and poverty may prevent many people who most need to understand the warnings that they are getting from these messages. Effective outreach and a greater understanding of where waters in the Willamette River Basin are contaminated are necessary in order to assess and communicate human health risks. HB 3216, as amended, would provide the means for assessment and public outreach. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the hearing on this bill. I would also say that the bill has, as all bills of this type, has some break at the end of it because it has a co-referral to Ways and Means, and my hope would be that this committee could at least refer it on to Ways and Means so we could start our work there, which is a long and arduous process.
Thank you. Representative Devlin, questions from the committee? Yes.
Representative Devlin, do you have any ballpark estimation on how much this would cost?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, my guess is that to start a program of this type with the discussions I've had with some people, we would be talking in the neighborhood of in the range of $100,000 to get a program off the
off the ground. Obviously, you could spend a great deal more, but we do not anticipate being able to get a great deal more through ways and means, and it would be a difficult job to get that $100,000. So.
Can I have a follow-up?
Yes.
We did a public hearing with the Salmon Committee up in Portland, and the Columbia Slough was one of the issues that was discussed at that meeting. And it seems to me that there was testimony given at that hearing that there is signage in that area about the dangers of eating fish that's captured there.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, there is signage in a number of areas, but the feeling is generally that there's not adequate monitoring, nor is there an adequate public education program. I'm fairly familiar with some of the issues in that area. And obviously you've got the issues of the Columbia Slough. You've got the issues of the whole Northwest Industrial Area, which was built upon wet fill on top of wetlands, that there are issues about contaminants. Obviously there are issues related to Columbia Slough and the Willamette, about St. John's landfill and leakage from that landfill into the Slough and ultimately into the river. There's issues as you go farther south on the river, issues relative to the River Bend landfill, and it's being adjacent to the river there.
Did you have a follow-up?
One more. We also had testimony in the Ways and Means Sub for Ag and Natural Resources about a study that was done by DEQ over a number of years that studied, I do believe, with squawfish was about the only thing that came out of that study with any applicable data on. Is that something that would apply to this?
Yes, it would. I'm not an expert in that area, but those were some of the background that has been given to me. Is that there has been some evidence of abnormalities in squawfish and I think some other species as well.
That's encouraging.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morgan's reference to that FRT meeting in Portland reminded me of a question that was asked and answered that day was asked by me and answered by Mayor Katz. And when the question was, what is Portland willing to do to help water quality and save the salmon, and Mayor Katz said whatever it takes. So I'm wondering at that point if you have approached the city of Portland as to how much they are willing to invest in this, because obviously they have a lot of money and they're willing to spend it on this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, no, I have not. I would be more than willing to do that. And I think the advocates for the bill would be willing to do that also.
You can quote me in remembering to Mayor Katz that she did make that statement. So I guess the last resources of Portland are available, Representative Devlin, to solve this problem.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gino.
Representative Devlin, what type of education do you have in mind? Sure.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gianello, I believe there's some definition of the outreach program that they're talking about in the amendments to the bill. I think there are probably other people here to testify that could probably give you a more detailed answer beyond what's actually in the bill.
Representative Devlin, doesn't the Health Department have a mandate to educate the public on some of these things already, on all the things that you have in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I believe they do, but like all mandates, all public entities, it depends on the resources that are given to them. I know that they are here today to testify. I think that they will testify generally in support of the bill, but they're always in a question about what's their higher priorities, and I don't know where this would rank in their priorities. They have a lot of priorities that they probably want to present to this body.
And wouldn't we need definitions for dangers of contact, dangers of consumption, potential health risks, contaminated water and contaminated fish? Scientific definitions, as close as possible. Wouldn't we need those?
Mr. Chairman, in a statutory form, I would think that ultimately those definitions, if it became necessary to define them more clearly, would be probably defined by rule. I don't know if we could provide clear definitions within a statutory sense of each one of those items. but I do think it would be beneficial in the long term to do that.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I'd like to have the Grant Higman with Health Division up chat about this too.
Good afternoon. Chair Welsh, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Health Officer and Deputy Administrator for the Oregon Health Division. I apologize for not having public testimony, written testimony for you today, but as Representative Devlin said, this was a quick turnaround bill. Conceptually, the Health Division does agree that this is a good idea and the public should be better informed of potential health consequences of contaminated water. When we look at the data, I can't honestly admit that this is something that I would say is our most critical health problem. When we look at data regarding deaths or reportable diseases, this isn't something that comes up. However, a number of people are beginning to pay much more attention to this. This is something that's getting a lot more attention at the federal level, and as I said, conceptually, we think it is a good idea. I did want to mention that we and DEQ are doing some things already on this. DEQ does have a water monitoring program that they do monitor primarily for microbiological contamination, but for some toxic contaminations as well. And then when there are increased levels of those contaminants, we do put out fish advisories. And as Representative Gubson mentioned, there are some fish advisories out currently for the Willamette. There's fish advisories out in Eastern Oregon for mercury. So that there are things that we're already doing. However, what we do is definitely, you know, tied to resources, and we don't have a lot of resources, and DEQ does not have a lot of resources for these activities. So I would really say that right now it is a fairly minimal program that we're running in regards to these efforts. And that's the big issue, is that you are absolutely right, Representative Welsh, that we do have a mandate to educate the public, to promote and preserve the health of all Oregonians. And one way we do that is to get out public education and public information. That piece of it would not cost a whole lot of money, but it would cost some additional resources. I think that the larger amount of money would be in the actual monitoring for the different potential contaminants and how aggressive we wanted to be with that monitoring, and then how aggressive we wanted to be with public education. The other thing I do need to mention is that although we support this conceptually, this is not in the governor's recommended budget, and we just need to know that. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Chair, each summer we read about the swimming places along the Columbia at the park areas being closed because of contamination. Who is closing those?
Mr. Chair and Representative Taylor, I'm not sure of which ones that you're referring to. The one that I can think of was an E. coli outbreak in Blue Lake a couple of years ago, and that was something that came to our attention through reportable disease reporting, and that was something that then the local health department closed down Blue Lake as a recreational area.
Other questions?
Mr. Hickerson, out of the estimated $100,000, how much of that would go for signage and how much would go for monitoring?
Chair Welsh and Representative Gianella, the $100,000 is not an estimate that we came up with, and I really can't answer that question right now. We haven't had time to prepare a real fiscal impact. But as someone mentioned, it really depends on how aggressive we are in this, how aggressive we are in the monitoring, and how aggressive we are in the signage. But I think that the big ticket item that's going to cost the most money would be in that aggressive testing of the water rather than in the signage and the public education.
Mr. Chair? I'm curious, you know, I would be interested in knowing, you know, whether the signage would be the most important or whether basically the opponents of the bill are interested in the monitoring part of it.
And Chair Welch, Representative Gianella, you'd have to ask the proponents of the bill whether or not what they thought was most important. You know, before you put up any warnings, I think it would be important to know what you're warning against. So I think that that is the monitoring piece is an important component.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just a comment. You know, I appreciate the sponsors of this bill bringing this measure forward. I live at the end of the Columbia River, and I'm not so sure that we aren't on the receiving end of something there that have been deposited upriver. And we have a good sturgeon spawning ground, and we have some wonderful huge fish who accumulate within their system and their bottom feeders. And so the importance of this bill should not, I think, be taken lightly. There are those of us who have stopped eating sturgeon as regularly as we once did. Are those very kinds of concerns? And so I just want to tell the authors that I think it is an issue of importance, and it's unfortunate that we find ourselves in a tight revenue situation here this session, and probably other things will take priority, but I think it is a health issue.
If I might interject, Chair Welch, Representative Taylor, you're absolutely correct there in that there are some contaminants, mercury being one, where once they get into the system, they do accumulate. They do not get out, so that the older a fish is, the more contaminated they're likely to be. And in the case of mercury, swordfish, particularly on the East Coast, do have a lot of restrictions because of that.
Yes,
thank
you.
Assuming that you were given this program, how much of the monitoring would you do, and how much would you farm out to other agencies? I'm assuming the majority of it would be DEQ people doing the actual, pulling the actual numbers for your folks to analyze.
Right. Chair Welch, Representative Cruz, that's undetermined right now. It could be done by local health department, sanitarians. It could be done by DEC folks, and that's something that we'd work with the Department of Environmental Quality to figure out what was the best, most economic way of doing that.
I guess the fact that DEC is doing a lot of monitoring currently, it would make sense not to send somebody else out to dip into the same part of the river, but...
And Chair Welch and Representative Cruz, and we would make sure that we weren't doing any duplicate work. And we have talked with the Department of Environmental Quality about this, and they agree that if this bill were to pass, that we would work on this together.
Is the DEQ here?
Chair Welch, no, they're not. They asked, I talked to them earlier. They asked, do you think that we needed to stay around? And I said I thought that I could cover it for the 2 weeks.
Sure, I appreciate it. Now, I wasn't intending to get into real depth, but with my talk tomorrow, I'll talk to the sponsor too, and looking at something like this, I think the common sense first step is going to be a scientific evaluation, and I couldn't feel comfortable moving any other direction to begin with. And I'm not afraid of finding anything wrong or anything right within the river. Downstream of Portland, upstream of Portland, or the tributary. I don't think we should be afraid of that. But I think we would have to seriously consider the scientific analysis, which is going to cost us some money. And we know that. And start determining, if you look at fish, look at water quality, and beyond microbiological issues, then that takes quite a bit of time and money. Grant, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Close the hearing on House Bill 3216. And I think right at the moment we'll open a hearing on, we're waiting for, I think, Senator Farrell and Simmons to come up together, but they're not ready quite yet. I think the representative is ready, but, you know, we're always waiting on the Senate. We will open on House Bill 3420. And who do we have sponsor on that? I think that was a committee bill, wasn't it? And, okay, Water Watch and Oregon Environmental Council. You come forward, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Hillary Abraham with the Oregon Environmental Council, and with me today is Karen Nowotsky, Director of Water Programs, and also Reed Benson, the Executive Director for Water Watch. They will deliver testimony on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Water Watch appreciates the opportunity to testify on behalf of on 3420, a bill which would strengthen water use measurement practices in Oregon. Water Watch and OEC have joined in support of this bill. We're grateful to the committee for having sponsored it on behalf. In brief, House Bill 3420 would require anyone who uses surface or groundwater under a variety of legal means to install a device allowing their water use to be measured by the end of the year 2003 and maintain that device in good working order. The bill would also allow but not mandate the Water Resources Commission to require measuring devices to be installed earlier than that and also to require water users to report how much water they're using to the state. The bill is intended to supplement rather than replace current state authority that requires that water users install satisfactory measuring devices. Currently, that authority comes in various forms. It's found in various parts of Oregon laws. The problem with the current authority really is that the Water Resources Department has been reluctant to use it. For example, the authority, the Water Resources Commission's authority to require water measurement and reporting in a particular area has been on the books since 1987. But the commission has never actually exercised that authority even one time. In the Oregon plan, the department committed to take a hard look at that. And in fact, the staff came back and said, you know, this actually could be a very useful tool that we ought to think hard about using. But there have been no proposals to implement the to implement that authority. And that is why we feel that it is time for the legislature to step in and place a deadline saying within 5 years all water users should be measuring. Essentially, this bill supports both good science and good stewardship. These are important points at a time when all of us are trying to stretch existing water supplies to ensure that enough is available to meet the full range of needs, in-stream and out-of-stream needs, for Oregon's future. Measurement is going to have to be an important component of any approach to meeting local water needs, whether you're talking about trying to move water from existing to new uses or to justify new storage. Without water measurement to ensure that water is being legally used and to provide good data on where and how water is being used, it's going to be hard to say that we need to go out and build new storage to address that situation. Better measurement would also improve the implementation and effectiveness of the Oregon plan. The plan identifies strengthening water law enforcement and collecting water use data as key tools to restoring stream flows, but here again, we haven't seen the kind of implementation from the state agencies that we would have liked to see in this area. They've been reluctant to use the authority that they already have on the books. I guess one last point I would make is that this is not, that measurement doesn't simply protect in-stream flows. It also protects those water users who are using water legally and within their water rights. And I guess I would point to a document that came out of the state of Washington, and I'll provide this for the record. This came from the Yakima River Basin Conservation Advisory Group, a group that includes two irrigators from the Yakima Basin, also state officials and environmental and tribal interests. They got together and recommended unanimously that the state and federal agencies cooperate on a program that involves measurement and enforcement of water use in that basin. And what they said is that that should be a highest, that the agency should give that program the highest priority as it protects those water users who comply with their water rights from harm by those who may not and puts them on an equal economic footing. It's really a basic fairness issue as well as being good stewardship and good science. We view this as a common sense tool. We've suggested a five-year phase-in period, and we urge the committee to support House Bill 3420. Thanks.
Chairman Welch, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify on Bill 3420, and thank you for sponsoring this bill. For the record, my name is Karen Lawatsky. I'm Director of Water Programs for the Oregon Environmental Council. In addition to seconding Reed's comments, I'd like to point out that water measuring is an extremely important part of developing water conservation and efficiency techniques. If we accurately measure the water that's being used, if we know where it's going, we're going to be able to examine the systems that exist and hopefully streamline them in order to use less water. That way we won't have to draw so heavily on storage or other sources to meet growth or other sorts of challenges that are going to be coming in the future. In addition, we think that it's also a good technique for planning. If we know how much water is being used, we can plan ahead for the development of new water sources, we can plan ahead for in-stream flows, we can try and address all the issues raised not only in the Oregon plan, but also raised by people like the Willamette River Basin Task Force, who do recommend water metering as one way to achieve cost effectiveness in dealing with water issues. Thank you, and if you have any questions, we'd be happy to take them.
Anything else? Okay. Sure. I would like to ask a question about the bill. It says that the device will allow for the determination of the rate and duty of water appropriated. Could someone explain, are we talking about flow rates or cost charge, and what is the duty of the water appropriated?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berkeley, the duty is the annual volume required to meet that use. And the rate is the instantaneous flow that can be taken at any one time. So the language in the bill is intended to allow water masters, the state officials responsible for enforcing the water laws, to determine at any one time is the water user using the rate of flow that they are authorized to use. And over the course of a whole year, are they using the volume of water that they are allowed to?
These measuring devices, do they operate electronically and report their finding, or is this a mechanical system in which one goes and looks at the dial and calls it in and so on and so forth?
Well, Chair Representative Merkley, they do come in both types, and most geological survey river flow gauges are the former. The bill does not require that degree of sophistication in measurement devices. So the manual type would be acceptable under the bill if we proposed it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Scott, would this affect farmers? Would they be expected to measure their water?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gianella, yes.
And why are you reluctant to use the authority that's already on the books from 1987?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gianella, I would urge you to direct that question to Water Resources. We believe that that is authority that they ought to use, and certainly they express interest in seeing greater measurement as a way to help the state manage the waters more effectively. We are sometimes mystified as to why the authority doesn't get exercised any more than it does.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow up.
Scott, there's a concern among farmers that the plan in the future is to charge for the water. Is that the future plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gianella, that would... any kind of a fee like that would have to go through this legislature or through a citizen initiative, and I know of no plans for any kind of legislation or initiative like that. I will say that that has been proposed in the past, and that legislation has been considered in former legislatures, but I don't know of anything like that at this time.
Thank you.
Lee, did you submit this same bill in 95, I remember it.
Mr. Chair, we might have, or it probably, I'm almost certain it would have been a component of a larger bill that we did maybe back in 93, but we drafted this anew for this session.
Other questions? or Finn Morgan.
This applies to surface water, groundwater, all water users, all the way across the board.
The chair of Finn Morgan, yeah.
Do you have any idea the number of the points of diversion or the points of usage that you're talking about monitoring here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I'm not sure who does. If what we're talking about is how many water users right now don't have these kinds of measuring devices and would have to in connection with this bill, we have asked that question, and I don't know that anybody has a good handle on the current extent of non-measurement. We think it's significant.
Sure. Okay, this calls for measurement at the point of diversion. If I'm a farmer and I'm using water out of an irrigation system, is there only one measuring device for the irrigation system takes the water from the stream, if you will, or from the underground water system? Or is each individual user of the water having to measure it individually?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berkeley, the bill is phrased in terms of the water right holder, and typically that water right would be held in the name of an irrigation district. Districts already, as governmental entities, are already required to report to their water use annually, and I think that in general the measurement by irrigation districts is already quite a ways ahead of where it is by a lot of the individual users.
So to clarify, your typical farmer receiving water through an irrigation district would not have to install an additional measuring device?
That's correct. I don't believe we intended that as a result of this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3420. And we do have our senators and representatives here right now, so let's open a...
We did have them.
As they went out the door, like herding cats. Okay. I'll open a hearing on House Joint Memorial 13. We can have Representative Simmons, Senator Ferrioli, up here, please. And anyone say they want to come with them, I guess.
Chair.
Thank you.
Go right ahead.
Floor is yours.
We have with us Bob Lee from Pendleton also.
From where?
Pendleton.
Pendleton.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing House Joint Memorial 13 today. I appreciate your willingness to hear the bill, and I appreciate all the hard work that you have put into this project. And I appreciate your sentiment, your support of the memorial. Federal fisheries managers are exploring the idea of removing or breaching the four lower Snake River dams, as you all know, as a means to recover endangered salmon. Scientists are uncertain whether removing the four dams would lead to recovery of the species, and breaching dams would eliminate barging goods up and down the river system, severely impacting irrigated farmland in the region and would reduce the hydropower available to the Northwest. House Joint Memorial 13 urges the President of the United States and members of Congress to prevent the breaching of dams in the Lower Snake River and encourages all efforts to protect salmon while protecting Oregon's economy and its citizens. The preliminary cost estimates of breaching the dams on the Lower Snake River range from $48 to $192 million for rebuilding highways and railroads damaged by the lowering of the river. Another $260 to $314 million to improve highways and rail lines to handle the 4.5 million tons of goods barged on the Snake River between Lewiston and the Tri-Cities. And moving of goods would require an additional 700,000 trucks or 120,000 more railroad cars than currently exist. Cost of replacing the power generated at the four dams has not yet been determined, but it is enough power to fully light all the households and businesses in the state of Montana. I appreciate your favorable consideration of the bill.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm here from Pendleton today on this is Bob Lazenka from actually Pilot Rock, Oregon. I raise cattle there. We have a great
Yes, we have a great lot of at stake in all of the Northwest in regard to the benefits that we get from dams on the Snake River, and I fully support the bill that is presented here today. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ted Ferrioli, Senator from Senate District 28, all are parts of 11 counties encompassing 17,500 square miles located from the just east of the Sandy River to the Idaho border. The area served by much of the Snake River drainage, engaged in commerce and wheat farming and ranching and irrigated agriculture. I am in favor of the memorial that you see before you today, and I hope that the committee can see its way clear to supporting this piece of legislation. I think it sends an important message. For one thing, it was brought to us by the AFL-CIO, who is very concerned about the jobs they have in not only in the aluminum industry there in the Dalles, which is quite significant, but also in the transportation and shipping industry that benefits directly from maintaining flows in the Columbia River system. The folks that are very concerned also are concerned about storage capacity on the Snake River, which creates an opportunity for recreation and irrigation and shipping. The interesting thing I think there is that we've been learning from the development of science that the benefits are rather uncertain. The newest studies that we're seeing are indicate that smolt survival from the alternative and mitigated mechanisms for allowing smolt migration are approximately the same as smolt survival has been prior to the installations of the dam. So the benefits are uncertain, and we are learning about the mounting costs of the possibility of removal of these dams. What I'm concerned about is the potential for setting a precedent here. Interesting thing that I think we keep hearing from Senator Gordon Smith, U.S. Senator Gordon Smith is opposed to dam breaching, whether it's in the Snake or any of the Oregon dams on the Columbia River system. He keeps making a comment that I think is kind of amusing. He says that when the environmental community gets ready to blow the dams up on the Columbia River, he'll be standing on top of them, or one of them. And it always elicits in me the thought that the response from the environmental community would be, well, what time could you meet us there? The point, I think, is that rural communities in Oregon are beneficiaries of irrigation and agricultural opportunities, and we contribute to world markets. About $12 billion in agricultural commodities flow through the Port of Portland. The whole Columbia River system drains many western states and Canadian provinces. It's a far larger system than just this place that we call Oregon, and it's a far larger question than just the Columbia or Snake River dams that are that we look at in terms of flow augmentation or flow reduction or reduction behind the John Day Pool or removal of the Snake River dams. It's a question of whether or not we value a sustainability in those communities, whether we understand the value of hydroelectric power that puts this region at a competitive advantage relative to every other region in the United States, whether we understand the strategic and economic benefits that flow from the Columbia system and the Snake system, and whether or not we are really willing to take a good hard look at the economic and social issues that also drive up this question. And I hope we can take a good look at those things, because we're always told that it's the science that ought to drive the question. And Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll just remind folks on the committee and in the audience that economics is a science, sociology is a science, and we have to look at those things in some reasonable framework with the biology and the other sciences that drive this question. I keep hearing that there are 200 scientists that have signed a letter that urged the removal of the Snake River dams, and I guess if I needed to, I could produce a letter that showed that 200 scientists believe that eating oatmeal reduces cholesterol, and then I could produce 200 scientists that say that eating bacon reduces their incidence at opioid breakfast. I think lay people have to thank our lucky stars that scientists don't set public policy and that elected public officials that are responsible and responsive to their constituencies do. So I hope you'll pass this amendment out. I think it's a good message to Congress. It comes to you in a bipartisan way and also with support by organized labor, and it will do a great deal for my colleague and I from Eastern Oregon to maintain our reserve with the League of Conservation Voters.
I would like to add just briefly that many improvements have been made to these dams that Senator Farrelly just touched on, including fish screening, bypasses, flow augmentation, and spillway deflectors. And these improvements have vastly increased fish survival rates, and they need to be given a chance to work. Some of the other organizations requesting the bill include the Coalition for Responsible River Use, Oregon Land Coalition, the Oregon State Building Council, and Construction Trades Council. And we'd be happy to address any questions you might have. I've got a committee that's starting. I'm the chairman.
Representative Wells, they can't start the committee. Mr. Chairman, they can't start the committee without the chairman, so he can just stay right where he is.
I was going to say.
Okay, I'll take a few questions.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to observe that I appreciate where you're coming from. You're Eastern Oregon representative and senator and a cattle rancher. I want to tell you where I'm coming from, the end of the Columbia River. And shipping is important there, too. My next-door neighbor is a tugboat operator who takes barges upriver through the locks to Lewiston. And I'm aware of the importance of the grain-carrying vessels that go by taking your product to the Asian rim. But I'm also aware of the cost of failing to recover the species. I'm not saying I'm an advocate of breaching the dams or removing the dams, but I know that there are hearings now in progress, and I do think this sends a message. And I'll tell you frankly, because I'm from Astoria and that's the way we operate, I can't support it. And I can't support it for the reason that I'm unwilling to send to Congress a message that says, under no circumstances should you consider this. I think under species recovery, We have to have everything on the table, and our potential loss of not doing so is to have the federal government come down and say there will be no more shipping on our rivers. I think that's a good possibility, that if we don't attend to every angle on these problems that we have within our state, that's the threat to me. And so I just want to be clear that Not that I think your concerns are unwarranted. I just want you to understand that I think there is another concern to be heard.
Mr. Chair, can I respond?
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate very much your perspective, Mr. Taylor. And one thing that I have not seen considered in the study of dam removal is all the sediment that is backed up behind those dams. If we set a precedent and pull these dams and sediment washes down and we go ahead and pull some more dams, it's very likely that all that sediment will plug up the ship channel. And there will be no shipping on these. I think that needs to be taken into account.
And Mr. Chair, if I might also respond to Representative Hill through the chair. I also agree that I think that there's no question that Representative Taylor is a serious and prudent and careful and good representative for the folks that live in the lower Columbia. And their issues are close to ours as well. We're doing everything we can on the salmon restoration program to make sure that the fisheries are protected and that we do restore those runs. And Mr. Chairman, the good representative from Astoria makes a good point. There is a cost. The cost has been $3 billion at the federal level over the years for mitigation of the Columbia River system. We're going to spend 15% of our lottery dollars on parks and salmon and species restoration. So we need to be cognizant of the fact that we are making an investment now. And part of that investment is driven off what we produce on the Columbia. If we eliminate the capacity to reduce these dollars, we eliminate the ability to mitigate, not only here but in the uplands. And I guess the last comment I'd make is that losing that economic engine will threaten not only the species that we're trying to recover, but the communities as well. But in closing, I'll say that there's something between your district and my district. President Taylor, through the chair, that something is Portland, and just for something to think over, when we held our hearing in Portland on the issue of the river management and river governance, we learned that the Port of Portland and the airport is 14 feet below river level. So the idea of dam breaching and the loss of the dams in the on the Columbia River system, at least, ought to give folks in the Portland area a little pause to think. If your office is located 14 feet below river level, you might want to develop a policy on dam removal. So I hope those folks are thinking about it, and those are the folks in the middle. Thank you.
Morgan.
I would just like to comment also that one of the things that really struck me about this debate is that the scientific premise of the effectiveness of dam removal, from my understanding, is based upon a computer model that says that somewhere between 30 and 50 years after the removal of the dam, that there is some degree of probability that native salmon runs will be restored on the river. And so it seems to me that that at best is a long shot. If there is a team of scientists out there that can correctly predict 30 to 50 years in the future, we could sure use them down here in Salem predicting our revenue sources coming in. But the costs of doing it, there are profound costs that are going to be paid by Eastern Washington and Eastern Oregon in terms of the economic impact and the social impact. And also the other thing that strikes me in this debate is that if you look at the big picture of the salmon's life cycle, you're dealing with a fish that spends a huge amount of its time in the ocean, another part of its life in the estuaries, and another part of its life in the uplands. And if taking some dams off a very small portion of the fish's habitat has a high probability of restoring that fish run to health, that just doesn't make sense to me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for either Senator Farrell or Representative Simmons. When will the Army Corps of Engineers complete its analysis of the biological and economic cost benefits of the removal of the dam?
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Dillon, I think it's within the year. I think it's within this year that they'll be finished.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I've stated before in this committee that my fundamental belief is that breaching of the dams, if we get so caught up into that single issue as a resolution for this issue, I think we will overlook other methods to address the issue. Because I think it's largely, and I just hate to put it in pure political terms, but politically impractical to actually gain approval for removal of old dams once people understand the full ramifications, and that a lot of resources would be used by all sides of the issue unnecessarily. But I also think at the same time that while some people may say that 200 scientists that wrote the letter to the president were premature, I would say at the same time that this resolution is premature, because we don't have all the findings yet. I know people have a clear understanding, or believe they have a clear understanding of what the actual impacts were, but I would want to wait until I got the final reports in from the Corps of Engineers, had the public discussion before considering a resolution of this type. Now, the resolution can be written in a less direct manner, but that may not be what the writers of the resolution want to portray. But I just wanted to get that on the record. In its current form, the resolution, I couldn't support it.
Mr. Chairman, to the issue raised by Representative Devlin, I agree with what you said, Representative Devlin. I think we all need to wait until
all the information is on the table. Unfortunately, messages are being sent daily by advocates, and that three out of four Western governors have stood very clearly in the light of day in public forums and said they oppose dam breaching. And I think it's incumbent on the legislature to at least express our opinion on the issue. And at this point, from the vantage that I look at the issue, dam breaching is not a good plan for Oregonians. So I'd urge you to move the bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just one comment, and then I would like to slip away. With your help, we were able to send a copy of this to the folks at the rally in Tri-Cities, held in opposition to dam removal, send this very language, along with the signatures of support from 35 representatives who are here serving in this body today, and 18 senators who agree that this is a good idea, that we need to make a public statement in opposition to dam removal. And I just want to thank you for your help with that.
Thank you for bringing the House Joint Memorial to us.
Before they leave, I just would like to note that as we are discussing this issue, we should remember that 200 scientists agree that Senator Ferrioli was at the Oregon League of Conservation Denial.
Thank you very much for reminding me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please, you were there, Senator. Thank you. And I didn't have to be there, right?
Well, Mr. Chairman, actually, I was sent to take a message. Senator Ferrioli wanted to be at the Oregon League of Conservation voters, but he was called for the Silver Farm to spray something toxic on his trees. Or he would have been there.
Probably so. Thank you very much. And due to our time, I really need to move on here. So we're going to close the hearing on House Joint Memorial 13. And we'll open, I'm just going to tap in House Joint Memorial 4. We'll open the hearing on House Joint Memorial 4, and then we close the hearing on House Joint Memorial 4. And I open the House Bill 3500, and would Representative Lundquist please come forward? And anyone else who would like to bring with him? Is he here? Great.
For the record, Lynn Lundquist, District 59. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for holding the hearing on House Bill 3500. I think the Dash 3 amendments are being passed out, and this is a gut and stuff situation. I think for the committee, perhaps one of the most important things I can say in regard to this bill is that this bill started out very early in the session. As many bills do, if you think are fairly straightforward, not many problems to them, but that did not, that attitude did not prevail. It went through the process. So what we had is we've had a group working on this bill for a considerable period of time, and they have come to resolution. And that, I think, is probably the most important thing. I will say that my staff, Jessica Harris, was the one who actually put most of this together and working at, and she would be here today, but she's receiving her master's, or she's making a master's degree presentation at the university. So that's the priority over this. What this bill does, obviously, is in regard to youth camps, and it creates a conditional use for youth camps on forest and mixed farm and forest lands. It requires that the rulemaking be done by LCDC to allow this to happen. The rulemaking shall be consistent with ORS 215.296, which speaks to the standards for approval of certain uses in exclusive farm use zones. The concept here is that we want to stay consistent with the rulemaking that's already gone forth in that process. It does not allow any camp to be sited until the rulemaking is completed. There's one section there that speaks about that. So we will not have any camps come and being sited. It does allow for the establishment of a caretaker's dwelling if a dwelling does not already currently exist on the property. And that, Mr. Chairman, is my brief description of a bill that, again, that I'd like to emphasize that the groups have come together on. I've been told that LCDC has a neutral position on this bill.
Representative, I appreciate that. And what I'd like, I have a page and a half here that I know we can't get to because we have to be out of here for another hearing. But I know those sitting right up in the front here would like to give some testimony. And I'd like Alton Camp and whoever we else have some time for. But honestly, we've got no more than about 5 minutes. So if they'd like to come forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, this may be out of order, but could I pass out this testimony on 3216 that they meant to, and so we can get it in the record?
Yes. And I want to remind those who don't get to testify today that I'm not going to move on House Bill 3500. They can submit testimony to or look for the next day that we will be next week when we bring it up again.
Chair Welch, Representatives, I'm Al Cooper here with the Oregon Council, Trail Council, Boy Scouts of America. We appreciate your time, ma'am. We're very appreciative that the legislature is willing to recognize the value of youth camps. We agree with everything that Senator Lundquist said about the compromise that has been reached. We support all of the things he said. We appreciate your listening to our Scout representatives. This has been a great civics lesson for them, and we appreciate your taking the time to listen to them. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen of the legislature, I'm here speaking to you about placing the resident caretaker in Weyerhaeuser Woods. By rezoning this piece of land, the Boy Scouts would be able to have a semi-developed camp free from vandalism.
I need to just ask you to state your name, then continue.
Andrew Grimes.
Thank you, Andrew.
By allowing us to use a caretaker, the camp would be free from vandalism and natural hindrance such as overgrown brush or fallen trees. I understand rezoning this land might develop or overdevelop forest land, and that might worry you. But the BSA does not lean toward the destruction of land, but towards leaving no trace and leaving the site better than it was to begin with. I believe that by doing this rezoning, hand in hand, we can help these young men grow physically, mentally, and emotionally. The Boy Scout program gives young men something to do, and I believe that if we can keep the few boys we have off the street and interested in a wholesome moral program and possibly get others interested, we can change the mentality and attitude towards teenagers and reduce gang activity. Many scouts join because of the outdoors and athletic aspects of the program. We have a new, clean, and unvandalized camp. We can get the MTV generation interested in the outdoors and conservation of the natural environment. We are your future. Please help make it bright. Because when you are old and in rest homes, etc., you can say you help.
It won't be long.
You can say you help make the state, or possibly the country, what it is then.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm Nathan and Bear. And this is a Leave No Trace book that this has. And this is a celebrity. So the thing is the scouting. In red it says county. Scouting means Abby.
Thank you. My name is Nick Costa. I feel that the Boy Scouts of America need to have camping grounds to do merit badges towards the rank of Eagle. We can earn badges if we can use the forest land. If we have a caretaker on our property, it will stay clean of trash and garbage because people will not trash lands that someone lives on. I would like to reach Scouting's highest rank, the rank of Eagle Scout, because I'm a goal-oriented guy. But the only way to do that is to have forest lands that we can use and that are not trashed. These are some of the merit badge books that you can only do in the outdoors. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming today. I'm sorry it took us so long to get down here and get everybody together so we can work everything out. Well, I'm happy you are. And I sure appreciate the scout leaders for bringing me to and giving us this information. I know we've been working a long time on the amendments, but if we don't have any further need for amendments, I would like to move the bill out as soon as possible. Gretzky and Lundquist, do you approve of the amendment so far? That's what we need right now.
I think it's on the floor now.
Okay.
And it's movable.
All right. I appreciate that very much. Gretzky, too.
I have a question, Mr. Chair, about I feel like I have some deja vu. We had an earlier bill about a youth camp.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the same area, the same camp, or
Gretzky,
am I?
Lundquist, would you like to talk on that?
Chair Welch, Representative Taylor. Yes, this is in response to the same issue. This is not just for a particular camp, this is for across the state. So it does answer all of the issues that were involved in the original one you're talking about.
And that was House Bill 3495, was it?
Yes, I believe.
2540?
No, I shouldn't say. I won't say what number it was. I don't remember.
So I'm trying to remember what their concerns were, and they were about roads and that sort of
fire, property rights.
Move forward, you can just a second here.
Very briefly, the original bill was essentially a supersizing bill that mandated approval of youth camps. We felt very early in discussing this that was going to go nowhere. One of the key features is that this is a conditional use bill gives counties full discretion to approve or deny, subject to the conditions that have been traditional in forest use zones for some time for other uses.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, that's the ORS 215-296 speaks to the fact that they have to meet all those the rules developed based on those types of goals and regulations. So I believe it answers the concerns that people would have in regard to camps in the forest area.
I appreciate that. We do have to get out of this one. I'm sorry.
Yes,
apologize for that. But we will have. I will leave it open here. We've had the initiation of on Bass Freeze here, so we'll have another hearing. So we'll have a chance to speak again on this. Okay. So we close on House Bill 3500. And having no further business, we close and adjourn for the day.